And welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbo's most Christmassy work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we, as usual, are coming at you live in the Discord. If you want the opportunity to get your discussion question in last minute, make sure you join the Discord at doofmedia.com/discord. You can join our live recordings every Sunday at 10 a.m. if you live in Australia. If not, whatever.
Discord tells you what time it is in your time zone, and I think the Doof website does too.
Yes, I think there's doofmedia.com/calendar will tell you the times of all the live recordings and stuff, I believe.
But not to gainsay Ruben, just a heads up for everyone, next week's will be an hour early. so 10 a.m. every week, but not next week.
I was looking at the note that said, remember to mention live recording an hour early. It just completely slipped my mind. But anyway, yeah, cool.
So next week will be an hour early for those of you coming live. If you are not in the live recordings, this probably won't affect you at all.
Yeah, but your punishment for not being at the live recordings is having to listen to us do housekeeping. We could edit it out of the episode, but I'm not going to.
But we won't.
Anyway, should we get into the chapters for this week?
Yeah, let's do it.
Before we get into it, can I just say, I don't know what it was about these two chapters this week. Nothing like crazy happens in them or anything, but just like these chapters were so good. I fucking loved them.
Yeah, were riding the hype train. You were sort of just pinging me on Facebook throughout the week, being like, "Oh, Pale is so good right now," which usually is the sort of thing that happens. Like, I think it happened in the middle of arc 13 and the middle of arc 17. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, the extra need to just insist how good the story is usually occurs when it's heights. Whereas, this is a relatively quiet time for it to happen.
Yeah, and I can't put my finger on exactly why. It just all was really good shit this week, wasn't it?
It was, but
like not like huge hype chapters or anything, but just very good chapters.
I think both of them also end in really like big, like hard hitting sort of aha moments, like the San Diego one, then straight to the Kenneteers finding out about their evil doppelgangers.
You're right. Maybe it's the cliffhanger endings of them. I do love a good cliffhanger ending. And really, when reading a story that is being released live, cliffhanger endings are just like so juicy.
Yeah, I mean, do you remember covering Pact? Like, every chapter ended in such a big oh shit moment, and it really carried you through that. And like, Pale is very good at doing it too.
Yeah, for sure. Anywho, let's get into the chapters, shall we? So 19.3, we begin with Avery. She's walking along the fence like a child before bumping into a kind lady with a huge dress, which gives me vibes of like being lost at the supermarket kind of stuff. I don't know if that came across to you as well, Elliot. Anyway, Avery befriends her in a classic Avery move.
I got really stuck on the walking on the fence thing because we had a fence walking club at my school when I was in year six.
No, you didn't. What are you talking about? Yes, we did. A fence walking club? Like is this a formal thing or just like a loose collection of people?
There were about eight of us. We had like there was a guy in charge who like tallied how much fences we walked.
What, like a teacher in charge or like another
student? No, he was another student.
Okay. Still, I gotta say, even so, this is very weird.
I mean, it was very formal in the sense that, you know, like, you know, we were marking how many fences we were walking on, how much distance that sort of thing.
You know, you'd get handicaps based on how well you played. Par for different fences would be different amounts.
No, it wasn't competitive. It was a very communal wholesome thing.
I like that.
Yeah. It was just sort of like, you know, we all were just pursuing the interest of walking along fences.
I mean, I do love walking along a good fence, I have to say.
I've fallen out of the hobby, to be honest. I don't do it as an adult, and I should change
that. Well, you got your fill when you were younger with the club, I guess.
Yeah, I've grown out of it, you know?
Mm, interesting. Sorry, what were you saying?
Yes. I'd actually... That's not in the notes. I just thought of that as you mentioned it. But yeah, that was my first thought when I read this. But I do really love Avery chapters that open like this, which is just like hard dropping us on a path and sort of having us on the back foot as well. Like, oh, this is a path. What are the rules? Like, you know, Avery's clearly comfortable. So there's not like this dreading tension, but there's still this tension of like, I don't know what's happening. There's a great one that I think sums that up is like the scarecrow keeper bends down and picks up a sickle at one point, and Avery's response is, "Oh, thank God, it was going to be so much harder if she didn't do that." Yeah. And it's like, normally the giant demiurge thing picking up a weapon isn't like a relief thing. So it's just one of those moments where you're like, oh, okay, that's good, I guess. Like, what is this? What's going on?
Yeah, no, it's very fun. It's very fun to be in the perspective of what exploring the paths must have been like for the very early finders, of just being like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
Yeah. Avery continues her streak of befriending literally every single thing that she comes across. And in fairness, it works out for her. So clearly the strategy is paying off.
Yeah. I mean, it's always sort of been the Kenneteer signature move, but it's so very much the Avery signature move, especially. And I love the follow-up we get from Jude later, where he's like, how do you know the path's about to go? And she's like, I asked. And he's like, I don't. Yeah, okay. Like, yeah, you just asked the giant scary finder killer. Yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's wild that this isn't, that being friendly to others, which is so clearly a top-tier strategy, has not, I don't know, there haven't been more practitioners that have learned to do that. I don't know. I guess that's the whole point of this story.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of make sense that, like, if you're a normal person and you come in and there's the giant lady who can kill you or gives you the tasks that kill you on this path, you just assume that she's not a friendly entity.
Yeah, I mean, I get it with folks like the ballerina, maybe, who are, like, clearly hyper dangerous. But, like, even in the Tatooine path where there were multiple suns, I can't remember what it was called.
Was just called like the Three Suns or something.
Yeah, where Avery was like, oh, the Burning Daylight, that's it, thank you, Charles Al. Where Avery just is like, oh, how's it going? Like, you know.
Yeah.
That's such a minor, like, kindness and clearly pays off. And it seems to pay off a lot. I mean, I'm sure this is going to permeate to the Garricks, for example, but, like, it's weird to me that other finders haven't started to do this.
Especially since it's like, it's right there in Hazel's book that they all fucking read.
Yeah.
That she had friends on the paths.
Yeah.
I do wonder if like part of it is not like a boon, but as in like the fact that Avery got her initial partner out of the Forest Ribbon Trail and made her familiar. Like, there's probably a lot of these little reasons that like Avery might just have an easier time. Like, there's a chance that if Jude had been the one here first and he was like,
yeah,
you know, yo, what up, the scarecrow keeper might have just been like, go fuck yourself, because
Avery is him. Kind of building a name, maybe not even a name, but like a rut for herself as others, like it's being
this is a world of patterns.
Yeah, exactly, a pattern, that's the word I'm looking for, thank you.
I do love how Avery though, like Avery has this moment where when she's just like quickly answering this woman's questions, and she's a bit like, it just says, Avery felt a bit bad. The woman had gone to all this trouble to rise out of the cornfield, be imposing, evoke night, put on her nice gateway to hell dimension dress, and she was just being bypassed like this. It's just like, I love the vibe of like, oh, you know, she went to all this effort to look like she was going to send me to hell, and I'm just being rude.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I can imagine feeling a little bit bad that you're just like effectively cheating at these, which is kind of funny. But I do think a trivia related path is probably my dream come true. I love puzzles. I think
disagree.
That's delightful.
That's Elliot, my worst. I hate trivia. I enjoy trivia, but I'm arse at it, so I require it to be zero stakes like pub trivia for it to be fun.
Well, how about this, Elliot? Because I know you always talk about how good you'd be as a finder. So let's put that to the test. It's time for us to play Scarecrow Lady and Walking Fence Path game. All right, here we go. Now, luckily, Elliot, these are all questions that I know 100% you know the answer to.
Well, at some point I did.
Yeah. So everyone, you can play along at home if you want. All right, I've got five questions for you here, Elliot. Let's say if you get 3 out of 5, you'll win. Otherwise, I'll replace you with an evil doppelganger, okay?
Okay, that's fair.
All right, here's the first question.
Wait, eviler?
The independent monarchy, and that's all that I know of it.
Oh, they're just the questions from the fucking chapter. Son of a bitch.
So what's the answer, Elliot? What's the answer?
Um,
The independent.
Was that the one that was just? Was that the one that was just a year, like 1462?
No, unfortunately, that's wrong. Off to a rough start. All right, how about this one, Elliot? The Cornish Prince.
Okay, hold on. Just give me 2 seconds and a few.
Yeah, all right, all right. No googling. Just for what it's worth, the answer to the previous question. Honor and Sakim.
Yeah, I just found Honor and Worship from Shame and Pride. I've got the page.
All right.
I've ruined your game.
See, now I know how it feels to be,
yeah.
to be the scarecrow lady in this bath, because when you can just Google the answers, it's a lot less fun. All right, how about this one? In the 1883 novel...
Captain Flint.
Oh, all right. Well, yeah, this is
no I can fun. Read, Ruben.
This is no fun at all. I give up on this game.
Yeah, okay. Now I feel bad. Avery's right.
Yeah. It sucks asking trivia questions when people know the answers.
I mean, I think it's funny that, like, Avery suggests to this lady that she needs to get new questions. I feel like there are a lot of other finders out there who might go into a murderous rage.
Oh, yeah, for Avery sure. Suggested. I mean, she's basically actively saying, I think it'd be fine if you, like, mixed it up and broke your pattern and potentially killed people.
Yeah, like it's there are definitely people who would look very poorly on Avery for suggesting that. But I really like this little idea that a bunch of these paths have all gotten their trivia questions from the same book of like lost trivia shit, and that's why it's like the same questions on like 50 different paths. That's so fun.
Yeah, that is good. But yeah, so Avery gets fireflies as a gift from her new BFF, and she heads out of the path to meet her dad, and they prepare to head out after a quick phone call with Jude.
I can't wait to find out that these fireflies actually have some, like, legit ability that will become clutch at some point. Like,
yes,
even
I'm
that
sure
stupid...
we're going to see what they are soon.
Yeah, even that stupid shitty knife became good at one point, so fireflies, I have hope for you.
I saw a comment on Reddit saying that fireflies might be like other lost practitioners or potentially others from this path.
That's fun.
Yeah. So maybe, yeah, I don't know. I don't know what it would be like, but I'm excited to find out as well.
Also, at this fast food place, Avery orders a deep fried pickle.
Mm-hmm.
Just continuing the very cursed food options that are available in the Otherverse.
That sounds delicious. I'd try that.
I mean, just pickles are so gross.
Well, you just don't like pickles then. It's not the fact that it's deep fried that's no, it's, the problem.
But also just like this is because this threw me for a real loop when I went and visited New York all those years ago was, yeah, people would just buy whole pickles. Like it's not a tiny sliver of pickle in a burger, which I can like not quite get behind but understand. But like just munching down on a full-on pickle is so cursed.
Why is that cursed? They're
because
nice.
They're gross.
I got given a jar of pickles by my neighbor the other day, and it was such a treat. You just eat them straight from the jar.
No. In fact, now that we're having this conversation, I think this has come up on Pale in Comparison, and Malia and Jenny are also as cursed as you are, apparently.
Yeah.
I think.
They also apparently really love spam, so
I'm yeah, not exactly. The right side. That's the company you keep.
I guess we'll see this from... throughout the chapter a lot, but I really do love the vibe of Connor here. Like,
yeah,
throughout this entire chapter, Connor is so fun. He's just like he's so in it, and so he does so well. I kind of want him to become a practitioner, maybe.
See, I'm just really gelling with him as like Avery's not really a blackguard as much as just like aware sidekick.
Yes,
and
yes.
What's fun is I think he's pretty comfortable there too. I see no reason for him to awaken because their current balance of him just being her sidekick seems to be working for both of them. And it's working for us. So yeah.
Giles Arl refers to him as Avery's intern, which I think is very apt. Yeah.
But Avery's great. Anne's intern. An intern can't have an intern.
That's a good point. Can an intern have an intern?
I don't know. I don't think so.
We'll report back next time. This chapter basically is now Avery going on a bit of a errand run where she just visits various people, which is classic Avery. The first group that they meet is the Council for the Local Indigenous Canadians to aim to just kind of keep them in the loop and see if there's any connections and bridges that can be built there.
Yeah, as you sort of mentioned, it's like this is the part that kind of sets up the structure for the chapter, which is, I mean, we talked about how each of these chapters, like first chapters post time skip, is like our reintroduction to each Kenneteer and like where they're at, how they're doing. And this is like one of the most Averyest Avery chapters, where she's got her fucking checklist of all the people she needs to go and see in the chapter. Like she's had a lot of chapters where she's just been buzzing around between groups, but this is one of the most mission-y focused, I guess. Like she's very intentionally got like a list of places and she's driving around with Connor. It's Avery seems to be doing pretty well.
Yeah, she's definitely having a good time just kind of visiting folks and building bridges. It's very classic.
Yeah. Before we get into the specifics of this meeting, I do just want to also say the gift Avery brings them is this thing she's cooked called a magic cookie bar. Which I had to Google what that was, and they sound pretty nice, but just like the dork energy of bringing
things. Sorry,
yeah, they are.
What is it?
It's like this weird little baked thing with like chocolate chips, coconut. Like it looks pretty nice.
Yeah, it looks delicious. Yeah. Magic cookie bars. Wow.
But just imagine coming to a practitioner meeting and baking magic cookie bars as your thing. Like that's such Avery dork energy. I love it.
Yeah. Wow. Chocolate chips, coconut, and nuts set in a caramelized layer on a graham cracker crust.
Yeah.
Ellie, can you remind me, what's a graham cracker? I feel like that's a very
American. I think that's just like a saltine cracker.
Okay. Okay. Oh, interesting. Sounds nice.
No? Okay, we're getting a lot of no's in the chat.
People are saying that is not correct.
I did think that was a weird base, so that makes sense.
Yeah, we don't really have graham... Well, I think they call them graham crackers in America. I don't know how much that's just
pronunciation. Graham's crackers.
Okay. Sweet flavored cracker made with graham flour. Yeah,
whatever. It kind of looks like an Arnott. It kind of looks like an Arnott's biscuit.
Yeah, it almost kind of looks like a mild shortbread cracker, I want to say.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah, sorry, moving on. I mostly just was bringing this up because I thought it's such a weird move to be like, you know what I need to bring to this practitioner meeting? Magic cookie bars.
Yeah. Yeah, not just baking cookies, but making magic cookies. Yeah, good stuff. But yeah, this is a very fun, like, section of the chapter. It's very much, this whole chapter actually really is just Avery doing some world building for us, going to visit people that, by definition, we haven't really interacted much with in the story yet. And this is a very fun one because it's clear there's a whole world here that Avery's just a complete outsider to, right? It's fun. It's very fun.
Yeah, and I like this sense of just, like, it doesn't feel like we're going to do a whole bunch exploring this indigenous side to the practice or whatever. It's just kind of like this, Avery's just touching on it because she's trying to touch on everyone, as she said, like, it would be stupid to overlook the First Nations.
Yeah, especially seemingly, or you kind of get the impression that it's a group that would be overlooked by practitioners like Musa quite frequently, which means potentially the exact kind of people that Avery should be talking to.
Yeah, and I guess to touch on the vibe of this meeting, and you know, I'm obviously trying not to go into this too much because I'm like a white dude in Australia. I have next to no knowledge.
You're
about
an expert in
First Nations people in Canada. Groups, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But like, I love their vibe of just this like very open distrust and like, I call it like mild hostility. Like they're not super hostile, but they're very clearly like not friendly.
Well, it seems like somewhat a generational thing. Like Mr. Harlow clearly seems to be the head here. Exactly. But also kind of very respected, very powerful, kind of old, elder in the group, seems to be very, presumably based on his life experiences, rightfully distrustful of outsiders coming in. Whereas I can't remember the other person's name, who's like more,
I think it's Joe,
connected. Yeah. Clearly more willing to like be a part of this world.
I think that part kind of maps to what I've seen interacting with like Indigenous councils here in Australia.
Yes.
And yeah, like I kind of love how Avery didn't really try to get around it or invalidate it at all. Like she just, she was never trying to say, oh, look, you know, you can trust me, like blah, blah. She was just kind of constantly saying, look, here's what I'm thinking. Like, and you know, not trying to get around it or undo it, just saying, yeah, fully understand. I'm just saying, I think like blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I'm not trying to do X, Y, Z. Like, I just, I kind of really liked that energy of her not trying to like, you know, do a 5-minute speech to fix relations between Kenneth and the First Nations people.
Racism. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, no, it is good, isn't it? Avery is very coming in saying, here's my piece. Like, if you want to, basically extending an offer for more collaboration that seems to be potentially interesting, but not something that they're like super eager to chase down, which, you know?
Yeah. And not really hiding like her connections to people like Ray or anything, or trying to like downplay any of that stuff. And I also love the details we get on how this First Nations Council, it's kind of the one that deals with practice related things, but it's also the one that's, you know, building the local school and like doing all this other community management. Like, that's not stuff that's completely separate in their society, it seems.
Yeah.
Which just like really vibes so much with, you know, everything we've been learning in these stories, and like the idea of like what practice and practitioners and the seal kind of are, that, you know, when you interact with like the First Nations group, it's much more just like part of life, so to speak.
And their relationship with the practice isn't bound by the seal, because obviously that is an invention that kind of postdates some of their traditions, right? So I found that very interesting. I know I keep saying this in the story, like, it feels like this is something that is such a deep world and we're not going to actually have the time to explore it in this story. But I said that last time about Liz's evil school, and, you know, we'll see, that clearly is going to start to play a role. So,
but I think unlike Liz's school, I agree with you on this one. I don't anticipate a deep Indigenous or First Nations practice exploration in this story. And we could both be wrong this time, but yeah, I don't know. It just feels more like a thing we're getting a hint at to like sort of help us understand that there's more options out there. But I think as well, like, and that does sort of make sense. Like the council talks a bit about how they work around the seal, or you know, how the seal interacts with them. And I guess that makes sense, because my understanding is like the way that reserves work up there is that there is essentially tracts of land that kind of, you know, the First Nations cultures get to decide how things work there. Like, it's their laws and stuff. So kind of tracks that in those zones, the seal would hold less sway, but presumably there's limits to that imposed by, you know, Canadian or American governments and stuff. So yeah, I don't know. I know next to nothing about this, so I'm like wildly speculating, but yeah.
But yeah, it seems like a very interesting area of the story for potential exploration. I really enjoyed Mr. Harlow's entire vibe in this chapter of basically being like, Avery will mention something and he'll just be like, do we know this? Do we know who that is? It's so clearly, he just does not care about this world that Avery is such a part of.
Yeah, it seems like this Joe guy is like, I mean, for want of a better term, their Avery, like the person who has their ear to the ground and knows what's going on around them.
Yeah.
Which is why he's the one who kind of is very much like, yeah, I'll call you, and like seems to really actually be interested in what Avery's offering.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. So we'll see how that goes. Avery and her dad head to the next stop, but on the way get a call from the phone lord. Avery attempts to ignore the call, but the phone lord becomes more and more desperate for a friendly chat.
I do love how in this Avery chapter, more than even most other Avery chapters, very extra specifically going around and meeting all these people Avery's been desperate to get in communication with. I'm the one person who is actively avoiding and screening their calls.
Yeah, I love this. It's a very funny call for you to make. Like, yeah, Avery is going to try and connect with people that she hasn't been able to get on the phone. And then we see this from the other side. And it makes it kind of sad from the other side. The way they treat people is just not fair.
Yeah, well, because all of this, it's all people who don't really want to talk to her and she has to win them over. And she doesn't give the dropped call the same due diligence.
How cruel. All he wants to do is call her up for a friendly chat on the phone, and instead she breaks all his phone booths.
Yeah, fucking vandalism. She broke her deal with him. Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Is Avery a terrible person?
I think so.
More at 11.
Anyway.
Actually, I mean, but yeah, I guess speaking of breaking the deal, so we do learn that Millie got out and has rebound the Bjorgman.
Nice. Well played.
Which, Avery, is like, yeah, it is good, but I mean, yeah, it's interesting. Like, Avery's obviously straight up avoiding this dropped call guy now, and we know he was part of an alliance. So there's like at least now an alliance of lords who are going to actively be hostile towards Kennet and the Kenneteers, seemingly. So that's, you know, seems like it was kind of unavoidable, but, you know, not.
Yeah, not great, still.
It's just like, it's a weapon in Wildbow's arsenal, it feels like now. For, you know, we've got a bunch of powerful lords out here who hate Avery specifically.
Yeah. I want to, again, just call out, give a shout out to Connor on this one. Like, again, he finds himself in this wildly terrifying situation and is suitably panicked by things like half-dressed bodies falling from the sky, but also just kind of, like, is able to stay on task and help get them out of there.
Yeah, it's like he panics but kind of keeps it together, which is very fair. I love at the end of it where he's like, he asks her for the post-situation report, and then he's like, you were in the situation. He's like, yeah, talk me through it though anyway, which is such a reasonable way to be like, Avery, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah. Also, obviously, shout out to Killwagon, who I think the quote is he smashed through about 100 payphones, which is kind of wild. To like, I didn't really catch the number 100 in there on my first read. And reading on the second time, I was like, wait, 100 payphones? Like, that's a lot of payphones for him to smash through all in a row.
Yeah, what a tank.
Yeah, well played.
Yeah, absolute ledge. I'm glad they've stayed in contact with him, like, and I hope we do get to see more of him.
So they get to their next stop, the house of Mr. Knox, Fort Knox, they call it. And what better way to break into Fort Knox than with two dragons? So Avery summons the tearaway kid to give them some impressive costumes.
We got to talk, though, like, this section opens with Avery chatting to Raquel, and it's obviously a hilarious exchange for a bunch of reasons, but I do just still love this energy that the Kenneteers are, like, friends with Raquel. Like, I have to assume, maybe not so much these days, but, like, in general, I assume Massa is not thrilled by this, especially because they're the ones who are getting her into movies and, you know, turning her into a little cinephile. But, I think we called this out, like, two arcs ago. There was, like, you know, Macaulay's friends with Verona, Raquel's kind of friends with Avery, like, you know, always sort of, and then I guess we've got the Teds with Lucy, like, that. The Kenneteers are turning all of the daughters of the head of the Massa contingent against them, and I just love that.
It is it is wonderful.
I hope we do get to kind of see Raquel explicitly turn away from her uncle at some point a bit. And I love how I love this moment where she's like, you can pay me back by getting your sister to, like, release more of her podcast. And Avery's like, she did say that she wasn't doing it because she has exams. And I remember Pale in Comparison took an episode off a few weeks ago because Malia had exams. So I feel like this is Wildbo telling Malia to drop out.
Burn on Malia.
This is a direct attack on Malia, I think. And obviously the bit at the end where Raquel finds out that she doesn't even listen to Sheridan's podcast. And Avery's like, bye.
It's a good sequence. The fact that Raquel is very obsessed with this podcast is quite delightful.
Yeah, and jackpot for Sheridan, because, you know, I don't know how many listeners Sheridan has, but if you have, like, one listener, but it's someone who can bankroll you, like Raquel at patreon.com/doofmedia, like, that's the dream.
Yeah. Getting one rich, you know, niece of a local power broker.
Exactly.
So yeah, this chapter, again, like, we really are just seeing a lot of the wonderful connections that Avery has made. Like, the Tearaway Kid basically just comes in and does a favor for Avery here with no, like, there's no, like, oh, I'll give you this in exchange or whatever. It's just like the Tearaway Kid comes in and is like, oh yeah, here's some crazy powerful shit. Have fun. Like, it's wild.
Yeah, well, because she's just established this rapport with all of them. Like, the Tearaway Kid was like that a few arcs ago. Like, at first he do you remember when she was getting him to spy on that person, and everything he was like, you need to promise me you're going to go find, you know, his weird bird city bird lady, and it was like, you know, when things started he was very like, okay, we can do this, but I'll do that. And it's like, she's like kind of proven that she's on the level, and so now she can just kind of call in favors because they know it'll go the other way too.
Yeah, legit. Like, it's very, it's nice. Like, obviously, these first three chapters of this arc have all been like, let's see post-time skip Kenneteers and how they've grown. But I really loved this one. This one was definitely my favorite of, like, the stuff that Avery pulls here is actually so incredibly powerful. Like, she is legit hardcore powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like, this whole favor-based thing, like, I remember she talked very explicitly about this in Arc 13 when she first made that deal with the Garracks for the money on the promenade. And she said to Miss, I don't want to be somebody, like, can't we just do it for each other as friends? And Miss and Toad's Wallow were like, no, it doesn't work like that. Devious. You need to establish thing first. And then you can get there. And what we're seeing is, like, yeah, it's worked with the Garracks. Now it's clearly worked with the Tearaway Kid. Apparently Killwagon as well, to some degree.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
You're right. And it's made her so powerful. Like, now she's zipping around the province, just fucking summoning fake dragons, escaping lords. Like, she's a fucking beast.
Speaking of fake dragons, another classic Connor scene this chapter.
Yeah, I mean, this is fucking comedy gold.
Yeah.
And all the follow-up too, the way Mr. Knox makes the joke about overcooking the dragon's egg while he was in there, like, it's just a great example of something that's really hard to do, which is a straight up joke about, like, lore in your universe. And then also, like, Connor explaining it to Kelsey excitedly too, like, he's all like I was a dragon, and it's like just tactically leaving out the details of what he did as said dragon.
How terrible of a dragon he was, which is very fun. Good stuff.
Also, yeah, the moment where the Tearaway Kid is like, try putting this on, and Avery's like, wait, you can share your costumes? Like, I think I, like, almost word for word thought that in my head when he went to hand her the thing. I was like, hold on, he can share the costumes?
Yeah, but like, luckily we see why it's not as good as you might immediately.
No.
Because these costumes are pretty rough to operate. But yeah, it's very funny.
In general, I love all the little moments with the Tearaway Kid. Like, every time he comes in, he just sort of challenges the human status quo in the funnest ways. Like, when Connor says he's Avery's dad, the Tearaway Kid is like, oh, I don't have one of those. It honestly seems like a weird way of going about things. which touches on what we talked about in the Reflecting episode.
Coming soon.
Yes. Well, I think to live listeners, coming soon. To everyone else, already came.
Yes, true. But yeah, so this chapter ends with the wheeling and dealing that Avery has been kind of building towards. She gets to talk to Clem and Samaniego at a cafe, which is a big name drop when you see it.
Yeah, that's such an oh fuck moment. Like,
I know, isn't it such a good ending? God, it's like the possibilities here, assuming that this conversation doesn't go terribly, are really very endless.
Yeah, and it's so good because, like, the witch hunters so obviously feel like something that should be aligned with Kennet, considering kind of what they are.
Yeah.
But, like, with all the history that we had with them in arcs, like 12 and 13, there's, like, some uphill climbing to do there.
History of Samaniego is, like, kind of a reasonable witch hunter, right? Like, he seems like he's kind of on the level.
Yeah, I guess I agree.
That's because the people that we met, the witch hunters that we met that were closest to Samaniego, also felt like the most reasonable ones, like the guy who could sniff out crime, who seemed like pretty chill and also was kind of a slightly higher up in the vibe. Like, we don't really know that Samaniego will be chill, but kind of get the vibe that the people who do better in the Witch Hunter organization have been chill, apart from the Montreal faction, who seem separate.
Well, that makes sense. I don't think you could run an operation like this and survive without essentially being able to run it, you know, like a business, right? Like, it reminds me of, like, you know, a lot of the times when you hear about, like, real life organized crime, the organized part is really key there. Like, a lot of them operate like a business and less kind of crazily than it's often made out in Hollywood movies, because, you know, it is actually their livelihoods, and it's more successful if it's more stable. So, like, I almost feel like with Samaniego, it's going to be I'm sure he's not going to be perfectly reasonable and just instantly forgive the deaths of his people, but, like, he's willing to work with people like Bristow, so he clearly is willing to cut deals.
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know, I'm just very excited to see where it goes. Who knows what it could actually be, again, assuming that this conversation goes well.
yeah, it's such a fun follow-up. Like, we talked so much about the witch hunters in arcs 12 and 13, and they'd kind of fallen into the background, and we wanted them to come back, and this is just the most oh shit way of that occurring. It's so fun. Although I do want to point out, it's interesting that Avery didn't want to bring her parents to this, because I mean, what, we don't have the read on San Diego yet, obviously, but like, I might have thought aware parents would be something that might help with witch hunters generally, as aware, like themselves, like another person, like I guess Avery being able to come in and sort of say, yeah, I'm not like an established practitioner, I'm somebody who's here to help people, look, here are my parents, yeah. I made them aware. I mean, it could go the other way, but I would have thought that would be an option to consider.
I think the gut feel is probably just that this is a potentially dangerous situation. Don't want to bring her dad into the midst of this. I don't know.
Yeah.
Although Clem's there, so maybe it's not too bad.
Yeah. Which I assume Clem, he wants to like start dealing with Clem, which makes a lot of sense. Like she finds tons of cool shit that they could use.
Yeah.
Like that seems like a mutually beneficial business arrangement for sure.
Yeah. God, just imagine how fucked the witch hunters must be at the moment with what Charles has done. Like,
It's going to be so fun to see where they're at.
I'm really excited to see where they're at, because I'm sure they're in fucking trouble right now.
Yeah. Like, that's the thing. I think we could sit here and think, like, talk for 30 minutes about stuff I want to see from the witch hunters relating to like their interactions of the story so far. And that, that's another one. Like, oh, it's going to be so good.
Yeah. Before we do that, though, let's get on to our next chapter before we stay here for half an hour talking about witch hunters that we'll probably see in the next few chapters. 19.4, we're back with Lucy, who is continuing to track this other, this unnamed so far technomancy other. Horseman insists that he comes along, but Lucy is reluctant to put another pet dog in danger. She's not a fan of dog fighting, effectively.
Whereas, obviously, the rest of us support it.
The rest of us, yeah, we love it. I play Pokemon, okay? but yeah, I mean, Horseman is making some very good points here. Lucy's like, oh, this thing can kill you. And Horseman's like, yeah, that means we're equal for once. Which is like a very good point.
Yeah, and I guess in Lucy's defense, you could say she's used to fighting like that, and he might not be. Like, John thought a lot about that in his fight in Break 5 or whatever, how he wasn't used to fighting, like he had something to lose. So, like, I do think, you know, she could have continued going down that argument. But, like, yeah, in general, I think, like, you're right. There's this super interesting relationship with the dog tags that Lucy kind of thinks about here, which is, like, John was obviously, like, a big protector and father figure in her life. And now she's surrounded by these guys who kind of remind him of her, but like it, you know, that relationship has been flipped. Like, we've talked about this before. Now she's the one providing them with guidance.
Yeah.
And specifically this chapter really starts to, I think, parallel her relationship with them with like what Jasmine's going through with Lucy, where like Lucy's trying to care for these guys and she's torn between, like, she understands they need to grow. Like, as Horseman says, we're meant to learn how to become our own Johns.
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, I get that. I just don't want you to get in trouble or be at risk when you do, which is a bit like, you know, that's not really possible. Like, you can't have your cake and eat it too. And I just think that's so fun, because this is what we've been talking about with Jazz for the last arc.
Yeah, it's a great pull.
Lucy has kind of adopted the dog tags and is going through her own version of Jazz's stuff. And that's just so fun. Like, I can't wait to see where this sort of goes.
Yeah, it's very eager. It's very interesting to see where this is going to go with Lucy being the parent figure here.
and it's such a messy, like, you know, a sort of parent or guiding relationship, because also they kind of remind her of the guy who, you know, was that for her too. Sorry, I'm just moving a cat.
Classic. And get out of here, Verona. Am I right?
And then also, like, I think it's funny because Lucy's also kind of doing parenting on hard mode, because her, like, children in this analogy are literal war dogs. Like,
yeah,
you know, they're going to get in danger.
Yeah, yeah. But on the flip side, they can't die. So, I mean, except in some situations like this one. Yeah, usually. So maybe it's fine. They kind of can parent themselves.
Yeah, I just want to bring up the moment as well where Lucy tells Horseman not to come to the fight and to go do something else instead. And he's like, I'm going to do that, and then I'm still going to come anyway. And Lucy's like, oh, she fought the urge to swear. And I was like, oh, come on, Lucy, as if you haven't pulled that same shit on everyone like 100 times.
Like, yeah, yeah, no, very true. It's like, she's going to enjoy more medicine here.
Yeah, nothing I enjoy more than, yeah, like, somebody in a story having to deal with somebody doing the same shit they pull all the time. It's just the best.
Yeah. So yeah, Lucy re-engages in the fight. She pulls some foxy moves against the other and its new cabal. And the Turtle Queen helps, agreeing to give back whatever she takes over. And no further investigation of that is needed.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a bit. I just wanted to call out this Reddit comment I saw that I loved, which is Lucy has this bit as she's chasing this other where she thinks, why is this thing so fucking extra? And as Forward Discussion on Reddit pointed out, she's asking this while wearing her witch's hat, her fox's mask, and using like magic to chase after it. Like, again, pot calling the kettle black there a bit, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I still continue to enjoy this multi-fox form that Lucy's kind of committing to with the winter glamour. Like, it's a really fun way of leaning into this vibe she's always had of like the many different ways of fighting back. Like, she's got some goblin methods, she's got fairy methods, she's got her war dog methods, and now she can kind of employ them all at once. Like, it's such a fun sort of way to capture what's so threatening about her as a fighter.
Yeah, she's got some really strong battle combat versatility. Yeah, like great. I mean, this chapter becomes a full-on Lucy fight against this thing soon, and it's wonderful.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the Turtle Queen again? Because every time the Turtle Queen comes up, we have to have this conversation about how fucking powerful and scary the Turtle Queen is. It's crazy. The Turtle Queen feels like she could solo this entire thing and not even break a sweat. And also just casually does wild, like, taking over of people in the town, including Verona. It's wild.
Yeah, but I'm starting to turn around a bit, and maybe this is just the trick Wildbo's playing
for the
on
trap.
Me.
Yep.
Yeah. But I'm starting to see or feel like we are heading along the path where, like, I can learn to trust the Turtle Queen. But I guess to talk specifically about her, like, power in this chapter, I think what's really fun is, like, because they do really need her to fight this thing, because its thing is also that it kind of is trying to take over this space, and that's obviously very much her shtick. And they bring Monty in, who's obviously good at doing something similar. Yeah. And there's this really fun kind of game of Splatoon in the office building later where, the three of them are taking over the spaces.
Yeah. I can't remember if it's here or in that office building bit. Sorry, I'll let you finish. Mine's a bit of a tangent, so I'll let you finish what you said first.
Mine was a tangent. I was just going to say, I'm still hoping we get three-way battles in Splatoon 3 next month.
Oh, no, that's definitely relevant to what we're talking about. No, I was just going to say, like, this bit where, I think it's here, it might be a little bit later on in this section, where the Turtle Queen starts taking over the Cabal members, and it's like, she takes over one, that one stabs a second one, that one kind of picks up a third one, and like, she just
positive
kind of
feedback
takes over this
loop.
Army. Yeah, it's wild. It's very scary how quickly and effectively she does this. While also Lucy says to her, oh, can you go do this other thing? And then she's just kind of doing it as well. Like, she's just like multitasking, doing these crazy things. You know, multitasking. I don't know if Wabo has thought about this before, but the ability to multitask and control various aspects feels like it'd be a really strong power in the right situation.
Yeah, it could be terrifying.
Yeah, I don't know if that's something that Wabo is interested in exploring, but it's kind of scary.
And I get just jumping ahead a little bit, it is worth pointing out as well, like, so this Technomancy other, as well as establishing what kind of person to some degree this first Chucky Angel we're going to meet is, I think it's really important that kind of the first other that we see from them is one that is here to specifically, like, take over space and, like, claim it the first thing we're seeing from the Chucky's Angels is essentially something that's coming here and saying, my space, mine, like, blah, blah, and they kind of have to fight it off, and it's really hard. And that, you know, it sort of sells how this relationship's going to go at the start, at least.
Let's talk about this other, because I think it's become pretty obvious what the next conflict in the story is going to be. Lucy calls Wallace, her guy in the chair, who reveals this is a video game thing. And of course, just like in real life, it becomes clear that the villains in this story are gamers. What else would it be? It's very realistic. Yep.
Gamers have always been the real enemy, and it's about time this story reminded us of the fact.
I think it's worth us pointing out, should I drop my prediction on you now, Elliot, or should I drop my prediction on you later?
Go for it.
All right. Here's my prediction. Who do we know in story who is a gamer who's been around for a while and has a connection to Kennet / the Kenneteers.
Declan.
Exactly right. Here it comes. Declan villain arc. It's happening.
I mean, the thing I hate about this is I can see it. I could really Does Declan go to St. Victor's?
I don't know. But yeah, like
I hate this.
Actually makes so much sense, right?
Oh yeah. Oh, there's somebody in chat, Tommy B, has suggested the three Declans.
The three Declans are the evil counterpoint to the Kenneteers.
Yeah, I mean it wouldn't surprise me to learn that, like, even if it's not Declan, it's like somebody who he's interacted with.
Yeah, or like one of the three Declans is like gotten pulled in. Like I'm not trying to say, as a joke, I would maybe say Declan has been a secret evil practitioner this whole time. But like really what I see happening is potentially Declan is going to have a connection to one or multiple of the St. Victor's people that Luce has taken over. And that is just so ripe for beautiful torment.
Yeah. You're right. I hadn't thought of that. That I'm fully on board with that. Yeah. It's so good.
I haven't seen Buffy. I don't know what Wild Bo's referencing.
I had forgotten that part of Buffy. Yes, that's fair. It's been a while.
Does brother become an evil gamer in Buffy? Is that Buffy spoilers? I guess I don't know. I haven't seen it, so what the fuck do I know?
It's been like 12 years since I binged it. I'll probably get a bunch of facts wrong, like the last time I tried to talk about Buffy with Scott. So, it's sidetracking a little bit. I do also want to call out that, like, as Wallace is explaining what this game is to Lucy, he says that this bad guy, whose name I've already forgotten, Father Gobar or something.
Gobar,
yes. Was the focus of the Black Candenza DLC from Void Opera. And I love how Wabo can just straight, like, that joke, that absolutely sounds like it's a game.
It's exactly what a video game would be called, and it's nonsense. Yes.
Like, yeah, he's picked the absolute best set of words to just throw together, and I'm like, that genuinely sounds like DLC for a game I could buy on Steam right now. Even though, yeah, he's just thrown a bunch of rando names together. It's so good.
I just want to talk about the fact that actually the villain is somebody who, I mean, you can just feel it. You can just feel this gamer who's like, oh, this character, Father Gobar, is so cool. It's like the fucking Torment Nexus tweet, right? Like, looking at a character who I'm sure is some satire of fascism in some game or something like that, right? And being like, oh, yeah, I'm going to pull out Father Gobar to fight on my side, and then I'll be the goodie because I have the villain fighting for me. Like, God, it's such perfect, exquisite gamer lack of self-awareness.
Yeah, and so for people who don't understand Ruben's reference, the Torment Nexus tweet a tweet where a guy basically says that a tech company releases Torment Nexus from the classic sci-fi novel Don't Create the Torment Nexus. Basically,
yeah, effectively, yeah.
I mean, it's real life. Like, so many products released by real tech companies are things from dystopian sci-fi.
To talk about a big one that's here in Sydney, in Australia, the company Palantir that makes surveillance software and named themselves after the evil scrying orb thing from Lord of the Rings. I mean, it's literally so exactly like Father Gobar is going to be a perfect example of this.
Yeah. I actually interviewed to work there at one point, and then you know how, like, when you get a job interview, you're meant to do, like, research on the company, so you know what you're talking about?
Mm.
That was what turned me off wanting to work there, so I went to research their company. And it was all news articles about all the evil shit they were doing.
Well, they used to sponsor the Suits barbecue a lot, right?
For
people who didn't go to the exact university that Ellie and I went to. The IT society at our university would host like a weekly barbecue, and it was often sponsored by companies looking to kind of connect with new graduates. And Palantir would do it a lot. And I think I was like, oh, that's kind of cool the first time I encountered them. And then as soon as I found out what they did, it's ridiculous that they named themselves Palantir, right? Like, it's got to be a joke.
Yeah, it's like we talked about the other week, where like I love this show on Amazon Prime called Upload, but the point of Upload, the show, is that big tech is bad, and it's this thing that is like causing us to all withdraw and not communicate properly and become lonely, which then makes us more vulnerable to the rich people kind of extracting, or like, you know, money and like just our livelihoods from us.
Mm-hmm.
And just the ballsiness of putting that on Amazon Prime is just like,
yeah,
you almost can't help but laugh at just like the fact that this story where Jeff Bezos is essentially the villain is on Amazon Prime and we can do nothing about it.
Yeah, it's let's not think about it too much, because it's kind of depressing the more you think about it. Instead, let's talk about this cute scene where Lucy calls Wallace, and it's very nice, and he's so helpful, and God knows how Lucy's going to explain this later, but it was very fun.
Yeah, because he's the good kind of gamer. His gamer knowledge saves lives here.
Well, I mean, he is literally living the dream of like being the phone-a-friend for somebody who needs to answer a gamer-related trivia question, right? And being like, yes, finally.
Yeah, he's literally living like 14-year-old Elliot's dream, which is his Pokemon trivia, you know, mattered.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he doesn't know this. He's going to have to stick it out with Lucy to the point where she makes him aware before he could ever know how important his knowledge of Void Opera truly is.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so they chase Father Gobar into an office building where they summarily beat the shit out of him. Unfortunately, Lucy doesn't double tap him and he escapes through her phone.
Yeah, and as you sort of mentioned, just like, it's not the sort of thing we get to cover in this podcast, but like such good action. Like this is obviously a huge chunk of this chapter is just like high octane sort of action.
Yeah, it's very fun. Such a fun fight. Like, Lucy just kind of dismantles Father Gobar. He tries to escape. His escape options are cut off by TQ and Monty. Like, it's very fun. And then Lucy ruins it. As this was happening, I was like, Lucy, your phone. No, your phone. And it happens. And, Lucy, you goober.
I'm not as clever as you. I didn't think of it till after it happened. Then I was like, oh, Lucy, you done goofed it. And I was kind of judging her, and I was like, I hope she doesn't judge herself too much. And it seems like she doesn't. She kind of takes it in stride, which is nice, because I would have been beating myself up about this.
Yeah. So, yeah, they follow Father Gobar into the digital aether, and we get our first look at the digital aether.
Yes.
In there, they fight Gobar again, and Horseman comes in with the big goblin gun to take care of it. So first, can we just quickly mention, again, the TQ takes over Verona here, and it's so fucked, and Verona doesn't seem to care how fucked it is. She's just kind of like, oh, that's cool. And Lucy's like, no, this is this is very dangerous.
See, I had the opposite read. I thought Verona was really freaked out, and Lucy was kind of being like, let's just stay on mission and talk about this later. Like, I think Lucy describes it to her as, you went from a girl who's really into cats to being all about turtles to back again. And Verona's like, I was turtle queened. And Lucy's like, yeah, so what are we going to do? And she's like, wait, I was turtle queened?
I got the vibe from that Verona was like, kind of, found it a bit exhilarating.
I don't think that's true, but I think fear was probably the primary reaction. And
chat
then, yeah, maybe
I'm down on your side here. So I think you're right.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I definitely agree that, you know, once she knows a bit more, Verona might not be as against the idea as you'd expect. But I think right now, because I think the weird thing is that Verona doesn't even remember it. And like, that's the part that I think really would scare me, is that you don't even have knowledge of the possession.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, so I guess to sort of touch on, again, like, you know, is the Turtle Queen going to kill us all? There's an interesting focus here on how the Turtle Queen interacts with the idea of teamwork. Like, very specifically, Lucy sort of is like, hey, come on, be a team player. And then says the Turtle Queen gives her a look as if she's never heard those words before, which is funny. But, like, it also kind of comes right after the Turtle Queen did a combo move with Monty to poison a lot of the priests. So there's this, like, interesting thing here where, yeah, like, because I don't think any of us have ever thought the Turtle Queen is evil so much as I've always more just thought she was like too much of a simple pattern who like couldn't stop herself.
Yeah.
So I guess I thought of her as less of a person to some degree. because like she'd have like less control or choice over some things, but like this here really indicates some level of ability to grow. Like, you know, I kind of get the vibe from her working with Monty here and this talk with Lucy that like she might learn to be a bit of a team player, and if she can grow in that way, I can see us being able to stick by the Turtle Queen and her growing into like a cool ally. Because like that suggests an ability to overcome the limits of where she started, you know, unlike Liz, for example, just pulling a random name out of a hat. So, because, yeah, the Turtle Queen, whose head we saw in 16 or 15 interlude, was scary. But if Kennedy's giving her the opportunity to grow, then I can learn to trust her.
Yeah, I think you're right. This chapter kind of makes you feel like there's some hope that the Turtle Queen will not just be a villain. she does do some team play, which is nice.
It's going to come down to whether she is like willing and able to overcome her natural tendencies,
which she seems to be able to. Like Monty has a few kind of lines with her that kind of lean towards seeming like that's going to happen. So
I've got my fingers crossed. I think it's far from a done deal either way, but like this is sort of like, okay, now I can see the path forward now, which helps.
Yeah. I think as Turtle Queen is in this story more and more, it's going to change to be more about the Turtle Queen. So we're going to get more and more Turtle Queen over the course of this story, for sure.
I mean, that would be metatextually appropriate, yeah.
We get our first proper look at the digital aether here, which is very fun. It required a biometric scan to enter, of course, because why wouldn't it?
Yeah, I had a real trouble not defaulting to just thinking this all looked like, you know, the real world in the Matrix.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because it was all pipes and stuff everywhere and the sky kind of lighting up the way it did. And I was like, the description, I was like, I don't think this looks like the Matrix, but it was where my brain kept defaulting to.
Yeah, Tron, I was called out by M Easily Impressed in chat as well, which is definitely what my brain was kind of picturing, like that cyber, like 80s cyber stuff.
I'm Googling what that is.
Or like that episode of Futurama where they go into the internet.
Yeah, it's just like Wreck-It Ralph visually, the digital aether.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can see. Oh, this is Tron Legacy. I don't know if that counts, but yeah, I can kind of see that.
Anywho, good times in here. That bit when Horseman is shooting gremlins and Lucy's like, how many times have you practiced using Bangnut as a gun? Which is delightful, which kind of evokes this image of them just kind of practicing down shooting cans, which is delightful.
Yeah, well, because we used to hear like about how John kind of got on with the goblins. And so you can imagine these younger war dogs just like hanging out with the goblins and getting into some of the same dumb rowdy shit that the young goblins are into.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Horseman gives major John vibes in this chapter, doesn't he? As Mirthstrike kind of says in chat as well. Like,
yeah,
this is like classic John stuff.
He, like, I know Lucy's kind of committed to grandfather in a lot of ways, like most of the time, but Horseman, you're right, has felt more John-esque to me than grandfather ever did.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one more thing we need to talk about here is there's a moment where Verona and Lucy kind of have a little conversation in nuance about their plan to kill Charles. And Verona seems to imply that the little guys are the key to taking down Charles, which is a clear indication that she's going to get the brownies involved again, the old Verona special. But yeah, like, what does this mean? Yeah, she's going to get the brownies to kill Charles. It's going to have Charles thank the brownies, and then the brownies will become lord of the region and everyone will eat really delicious food.
Yeah, no, you're right. All those dots, they're so close together now that, you know, now that I see it.
It all makes
laid
sense.
Out in front of me.
But yeah, like, what do you think this means?
I mean, I guess I'm not at all confident in, but like part of me is like, oh, is this, you know, we used to talk about like replacing the lords and judges kind of looking like, the way the monarchy has sort of been replaced in England, where it's like, it's still there, but it doesn't actually have any real legislative power anymore. And it's actually handled by, you know, democracy essentially. And so the little guys is Verona pushing for a democratic alternative to the judges feels like a real stretch, but that's the best I've got.
Yeah, I could see it being referencing giving power to the little people, giving power to the folks.
Genuinely, what's interesting about the world of the Otherverse is you would need to have a serious conversation about what the line is where somebody gets a vote. Like, because obviously we're going to draw it so others get a vote, but like, what exact capabilities, facets of your personality, etc., do you need to be able to get a vote? Because the line of personhood is multifaceted and very murky on a lot of those facets in this world in a way that's like, I don't know that I'd ever be comfortable deciding where those lines are, but to some degree, I think if you wanted to have democracy, you'd kind of have to. Mm. And like, that's that'd be such a sticky conversation.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, does the Turtle Queen get a vote? Because she's just going to vote for herself, for example.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I don't know.
But yeah, or like minor spirits and echoes and stuff. Like, at what point does an echo get a vote, if ever? Like, hard questions to answer there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I'm very excited to learn more about what Verona's bloody plan actually is.
So yeah, Lucy then heads to see Wallace, but unfortunately overhears his mum being pretty terrible about her, and she leaves. But Wallace pursues her.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, the disappointing or like the tricky thing about Wallace's mum here for me is it's kind of like the way I see it is she's like a bit of a control freak, right? Like, she wants to know Wallace is safe and kind of have some sort of degree of understanding or control over most of his life so she can protect him. And like, that's why I think she brings up Savannah, because as she says, she's friends with Savannah's mom, and it's like, you know, that's a very known quantity that she'll be able to exercise control over. And so like, the racism angle is almost like this side effect of the core problem, like, because the racism comes from the xenophobia of Lucy being unknown, and like, that's where the concern comes from. And it's like that, you know, as Lucy has often talked about, it's that indirect or more subtle racism which is harder to call out because it's not the root of the problem to a degree. Like, I mean, Lucy does call it out to a degree where she says her, you know, his mom could have just gotten to know her and fixed it. But like, I don't know, it's tricky because it's that racism, but not in its purest form, which almost makes it harder to root out or like address.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I mean, I think it is, Lucy relates this back to her experience with Paul's family, and it's very clearly like demonstrating the implicit racism here. But you're right, it is, as Lucy has talked about in the rest of the story, like, it's so insidious in the way that you can't quite argue against it without pointing at the wider picture of how it keeps happening across different people and different situations. Yeah. Like,
because it's not, like, my understanding is that I wouldn't say Wallace's mom is saying don't date Lucy because she's black. She's saying don't date Lucy because I don't know stuff about her. And the reason you don't know stuff about her or whatever is because she's black.
Or even the, like, she might not even have that thought if it was a little blonde-haired white girl.
Exactly,
right? Like,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Yeah. It's such an interesting problem because she's not, you know, she's not walking around with a Confederate flag, you know, just outright sort of saying racist things, which gives her that little bit of leeway to not realize that she's being racist, which makes it like kind of harder to really confront the problem. Mm. And like, you know, this is so much of what Lucy's been dealing with in this story.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, Wallace passes the Paul test, let's call it.
Yeah.
So well played, Wallace.
Yeah, because like, I was 100% on Wallace's side here. Like, I very much, I mean, I still do this with my mom, but with the vibe of where, you know, she brings up a point that you've fought over a bunch of times, and then she brings it up, and you just like ignore it and just like brush it as, yeah, yeah, whatever, mom. Like, I very much get that. So, I think, you know, when he runs after Lucy and is like, you know, this is why I did that, I was like, I think that's as well as you could really play it, because I'm not going to blame a 14-year-old for bucketing his mom doing this as something where he's just going to ignore it because I don't know that there's another solution. Mm. Whereas, like, in Paul's case, like, you know, he's a full-on adult, and when his parents attack his family like that, he's in a position to, you know, tell them to go fuck themselves. Whereas, you know, Wallace has a different power dynamic with his mom, and I get making the decision to just brush her off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, I think, yeah, like, he's only 14, the reason he wins...
Yeah.
So yeah, the reason he wins is because he runs after her, which is like the right call, because it's like fine to ignore or whatever. And it's just the two of them, but then he has to come and tell Lucy. He has to communicate with Lucy, and he does.
Yeah. So well played, Wallace. Thumbs up. But yes, they converse, and Wallace reveals something interesting about this Father Gobar stuff. The code for Father Gobar is reminiscent of the code that they're taught at St. Victor's, and there we have it, the smoking gun.
Yeah, this is so fun. Can't wait to meet Chucky's angels and see how their reflections of the Kenneteers.
But can we touch on this? When they're kind of thinking about where this might have come from, Lucy and Verona think that this might be related to the pyramid head other that Avery fought in the BHI Civil War, which seems to be maybe not the case if it's...
Yeah, I'm assuming that was just wrong, but it makes sense that they thought that. Because that's definitely the line I was thinking along last week when we talked about this probably being like Freeman.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really until they started, like when Zed, I think, starts talking about how inefficient it was this chapter, where I was like, oh, okay, no, it's more likely the St. Victor's kids. But like, I think without sort of that detail, like speculating that it's related to the only other rando technomantic other that's attacked you makes sense.
I don't know.
It is a shame though, because I do want to know where that who sent that pyramid head. We've never had that answer.
Yeah, like is the connection Freak? Is the connection? Yeah,
I don't know. Freak it was doesn't at the seem BHI. Like the
connection would be Liz or St. Victor's. That feels wild, because that obviously doesn't match up timeline wise.
No, it must just be somebody else at the BHI that hasn't come up again. I think that's just a fully separate thing. Once we learn more about where Father Gobar came from, I think my interpretation was just they were wrong in that speculation. I can't wait to see the Chucky's angels or our evil Kenneteer doppelgangers. Part of me's assuming there'll just be three of them, but there's no reason there'll just be three of them. It'd just be funny if there were. But I just love this because, like, conceptually, you think evil Kenneteers would have been something that would happen quite early in the story. It almost seems a bit late on the one hand for this small town to have three evil opposite practitioners or whatever. But what's going to be fun about this dynamic is we've already seen with Father Gobar, one of the things that's going to define these Chucky's angels is they're incredibly powerful upstarts because they've got really powerful benefactors, which is what the Kenneteers were at the start of the story. So it's going to, I feel like we're going to get this really fun reflection where it's like the Kenneteers are going to have to be going up to these new Chucky's angels and be like, no. You don't understand. You've been brought into this world by wild and out of control others who are evil, and you have to trust us. We have experience in this world, and we understand what status quo should be. They're going to be on the other side of the whole first half of this story in a really fun way.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting mirror for sure.
Just the idea that, these are going to be practitioners being superpowered by, crazy by powerful benefactors.
Others. Yeah.
And they don't know as much about this world, but it's not going to matter because they've got access to more raw power. It's going to be the Kenneteers fighting who they were at the start of the story, and that's so fun. And then, on top of that, since Liz is one of their major patrons, they are, in a very real sense of the word, going to be the practitioners of Kennet, which is, a really fun attack on the Kenneteers that we haven't had in this story. The one consistent thing they've always claimed is that they're the practitioners of Kennet, and this will be potentially the first attack on that role for them. These are other practitioners of Kennet chosen by the city spirit. So they might even, to some degree, have more claim over that role, which is very fun to think about and really continuing to set up this Liss versus Miss dichotomy.
Yeah. Yeah. Very interesting.
And then I suppose the other thing I wanted to mention, about what we could do with them, I'm so enamored by this idea. I've just been wildly speculating what we could do with them. In 18.Y, when Charles talked about them, he mentioned them as being ambassadors for what Charles and stuff were doing. So again, you got this other comparison to Miss, where Charles is seeing whatever they set up at St. Victor's as them defining their version of the Kenneteers, their ambassadors who will decide what they, or show off what they think practice is about. So I can't wait to see them because it's also going to we're going to be able to read into what is Charles's and Co's, what do they think the practice should look like? Because he's creating this world that's removing the concept of innocence and you know, creating all these Kennet Blows, and where does he think practice fits into that is such an interesting question.
Also,
they come from the Catholic school. So the guy who went to an Anglican school in me is really hoping they lean hard into, like, the ritualism.
Interesting.
At the risk of offending all of our Catholic listeners, my read on Catholicism as a boy who went to an Anglican school is that it's like Protestant Christianity, just with a bunch of pagan ritual stuff on top. Like, Catholicism's always seemed much more rooted in a lot of rituals than most Protestant stuff. So I'm really kind of keen to see it maybe lean in that direction. Although if Catholic schools are anything like they are here in Australia, over in Canada, there's not really any guarantee that they're hugely Catholic as people.
But when
I went to a Catholic school here in Australia, it was like, I wasn't really Catholic, and you didn't really have to be Catholic, but you still go through like a lot of the ritual stuff, so that like I would still expect students from that school to be have an easier time leaning into more ritualistic stuff.
Well, I'm so excited to see it. Like, yeah, it's very fun. But yeah, I mean, we'll have to see it next time, I suppose.
Yeah. Because I feel like the Kenneteers are going to want to try and win them over. And I just think it's going to be so fun seeing them be on the other side of the conversations that defined the first half of this book. But now they're in the right, but the other way.
Yeah. But that'll, we'll see how the evil school shapes up in the future. We've got a few interesting things lining up for this arc, huh? The Samaniego chat and the showdown with Liz's school kids. So we'll have to see how that goes in the coming weeks. But for now, it's time for us to wrap up the discussion of these two chapters, but not yet wrap up the episode, because we still have some more stuff to do. First of all, a quick reminder, folks, that if you want to make some predictions, as I made this week, my great Declan prediction, and
which I'm fully on board with.
Yeah, you can do that by finding the link to our Pair Protector form in the show notes down below. We haven't got that many predictions at the moment, but definitely send in your predictions, and we usually will read out predictions that we really like on the show.
Yeah, I mean, hit us up with your I mean, we need a better term, because as the chat has pointed out, and I agree, Chucky's Angels feels better, like, to talk about Seth and his other crew of Forsworn. So we need like a term for the evil Kenneteers. I don't know if there was an evil set of Planeteers or Musketeers. The listeners.
Let's talk about discussion question answers, shall we?
So the discussion question we ran over the last 2 weeks was, if you were a goblin, what do you think your shtick might be?
Very fun discussion question. I really loved it.
Somebody suggested Negateers, which I like.
Oh, Negateers is fun. What was your favorite one, Elliot? Which was my favorite? I'm trying to think. Oh, you know what? I'm going to call out the Bavarian Barbarian as one of my favorites. Who IRL has very flexible joints, which means that they kind of would hyperextend that as their goblin version of themselves to basically be a kind of like squishy, boneless blob octopus. Hard to grapple, a very terrifying thing that would just kind of, you know how octopi can like fit through tiny little spaces, like that kind of vibe. Yeah. I think that's very fun.
Although if I might make a suggestion to Bavarian Barbarian, I don't think get rid of the bones entirely, because I think it's grosser and more upsetting if you do still have bones. They're just very stretchy and bendy. Like, I think an octopus is less gross than that guy from that X-Files episode who fits through the vents by just stretching himself a bunch and like fucking up his bones. Like, I think it's more fun if there's definitely bones in there and you're bending them and they look weird.
Yeah. You're right, that would be more terrifying.
So I totally love Bavarian Barbarian's direction they're going in. I just think, just keep the bones, because that's worse and that's more goblin.
Yeah. I think a minor goblin that would be very fun to read about was Smunchlets, whose whole shtick would be baiting people into annoying jokes, e.g. D's nuts or like what's up dog style of things.
Yeah.
Which would be kind of fun.
Yeah, it reminded me of Slagar, who slavishly slays, like a similar-ish sort of thing where you're controlling the words around you.
Yeah, and if somebody falls into your word trap, you get a boost. It's just like so annoying in a very goblin-y way.
We got an answer from Vice for Psy as well, who, you know, sometimes goes by VV, who mentioned that they wanted to be a bump in the night, a bit like DD, but they outlined some sort of technomantic-ish gear they might have, like headphones absolutely chock full of earwax, which lets you hear like heartbeats and other sort of bodily sounds more easily. And they talked about their goblin's end goal would be becoming a VTuber who uses like a goblin model as their model. To hide the fact that they're really a goblin.
Yeah, yeah, I like that. The VTuber goblin is a very fun idea.
I also liked Screws' answer. So first off, they wrote a bunch about being an Oni goblin, which it was cheating. But then they did talk about being a sort of techno goblin / gremlin who jams bits of electronics in their head to try and like access the internet from their head. And so they talked about like being able to sell goblin shit on eBay or just like trolling on places like 4chan. Which, you know, in the other verse is probably about 70% of 4chan's users is little goblins with shit jammed in their head doing this, now that I've read it.
Maybe the grossest one and the one that really affected me the most was Fleet Feathers, who came up with a trio of goblins that were all focused around fungal infections. So that made me very uncomfortable, which I guess is makes it a sign of a successful gobsona.
Yes. So we've got to talk about this word gobsona that was introduced by Tomato Sauce 3. It might be the most cursed word that has ever come out of the internet.
It's pretty good.
It works. That's what I hate about it, though, is that it works. Their gobsona was somebody who's all about like it being imposing but not really being able to back it up, so this kind of take on imposter syndrome. So they're talking about like scars, but they're actually tattoos of scars, constantly swearing, like just sort of trying to give the impression that they're this major badass, but it's actually, none of it's real.
Exactly, which I think is very fun and a very unique goblin take for sure. What else do we get?
I liked I'm Easily Impressed's answer. So first of all, they clarified why they're a Power Reflections listener, because they think if they were a goblin, they'd focus on being amazed at mediocre things. So the whole vibe of their answer kind of reminded me of Ram Jam a bit, where it was like they're just amazed at things like, oh, what a cool lunchbox, or like what a great pair of socks, which is like how Ram Jam is with nails. But they're sort of a bit like that with everything kind of mediocre, and then they're unimpressed by actually cool things. And so they're talking about the power they get there is like undermining when people do really big or cool things, because that doesn't impress them.
Yeah, almost like a kind of a mild skeptic, but a goblinized version of this, which I think was a pretty cool idea. We got Sweet Manzana, who, again, succeeded in making a goblin word find genuinely disgusting, which I think is a sign of success. All around bodily fluids and stains, and really the word ooze probably is a pretty key feature of describing this goblin.
So my understanding was it was a goblin who sweats all their bodily fluids. So they sweat pus, they sweat blood, they sweat more sexual fluids, I guess. And so they're just like leaving stains everywhere they go. And when they're full, they like look really bloated. And then like they get really wrinkly as they dry out because they've sweated all their fluids.
Gross.
And they call themselves scum sweats, which is a very good name.
Terrible. Terrible stuff. Oh, and then we had a late entry from Beluga. Beluga's goblin form would be really themed around, I guess the way I describe it is like finding the weak link in a chain and breaking it, like always breaking weak things, which is kind of heartless from Beluga, I gotta say.
And so we did get another Discord last minute answer from Jarl Zal, which I'm just quickly reading now. Basically, a whole bunch of like snot and mucosal leaking is kind of my quick summary of this answer.
Gross. I'm glad I haven't read that one then.
like you know, sealing a handshake, and you know how sometimes like people will spit on their hands to like,
yeah.
But when they do it, it comes out really mucusy and sticky.
Gross.
That's a good one.
Yeah. Good.
As somebody who
right word for it
was recently about 80% mucus by volume on the back end of having COVID, I can relate to this answer.
You were this goblin for a bit.
Exactly.
So, Elliot, we've got a new discussion question, but I've got a different one to pitch at you.
Oh, okay. Hit me with it.
Which video game monster would you summon to be an other?
Oh, that's more fun. Yeah, let's do that.
All right. So that's going to be
our new discussion. My one's too serious and boring. Folks. Yeah.
We can get back to your more serious, story-driven one next time.
Okay? Yeah, I'll leave it in there. It's a good backup one, but yeah, I like this one.
So if you were going to summon a character from a video game as an other... Who would it be? Which video game character would you summon as another? Along the lines of, obviously, Father Gobar. As a buddy, as a warrior, it's up to you. Take whatever you want from this one.
Yeah.
As a familiar? I don't know.
I mean, who's your answer, Ruben?
You know, I was thinking, I've kind of restricted myself in my head for some reason arbitrarily to just thinking of like video game characters that already are like allies, you know, like a Yoshi kind of character. I think Yoshi is not a good example because summoning Yoshi, the whole tongue thing would get very weird very quickly.
Probably a lot of drool cleanup.
Yeah. I don't know. I wonder if there's an interesting thing you could do with if you had Master Hand summoned and then you could like not just like control a fighters and kind of bring toys to life vibes, maybe Geno from Super Mario RPG. I don't know. All kinds of options.
Yeah. So I guess yeah. Hit us up with your answers.
Who would you pick?
Oh, no, I feel like I'm not remembering most of the video games I've played, so I'm struggling to think of what I'd want. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of Pokemon to choose from. Like, I feel like we'll get a lot of Pokemon related answers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I guess it does depend on what you want to do. Like, if you want to fuck shit up, you could go for like Kratos or Kirby or something.
Yep. If you want to jump around in markets, you might summon Aladdin from the old Super Nintendo Aladdin game. He's very good at swinging around on windows and things, if that's what you do.
Is summon Narvi from Ocarina of Time and stick her on your enemies.
Anyway, so leave your thoughts to your answer to that discussion question in our discussion thread, which you will find linked in the show notes down below.
Yep, don't forget to check out our Twitter. We post memes there.
Every
regular
day.
Yep.
At Paraflexcast.
We've currently got a series going on. We got some extra materials leaked to us by the leakers, so we've been posting those.
Yeah.
Very exciting stuff. So you can get a preview of where the story's going from here on our Twitter feed.
Yeah. So stay tuned for that on our Twitter feed. But yeah, if you want to check out other more about the Duff Media Network, you can head to duffmedia.com. You can find there all the things that you might want, including a hot new recipe for magic cookie bars, which is coming soon. So make sure you check the website every day for that. But you can also find information about all the other great shows on the Doof Media Network.
Yep. And, you know, while you're in love with the Doof Media Network, don't forget to hit up our Patreon, patreon.com/Doof Media. Do what Raquel would do. You know, what would Raquel do? That's the lesson from Pale, I'm pretty sure.
Yes. Support our big supporter. If you're in the market for somebody to support, of course, why not check out Wildbow's Patreon at patreon.com/Wildbow. Elliot, do you want to give us a great joke to take us home on?
Something about the St. Victor's kids, the Negateers.
Yep. And that's it. Yeah.
That's your good. Turn. Thank you. That's the joke.
That was perfect. I think, and with that, we'll see you next time. Bye, folks.